are going to have Betty Sue Brewster come and share with us a couple of times today. And Betty Sue is likely a familiar face to many of you. She has been coming to Glenwood. She said she started in 2000. She was traveling back and forth from California to here, but has been here full time for the last 10 years. And a great question to ask Betty Sue is, where are you traveling next? She teaches around the world. Was it most recently in Albania? Was that right? Yep. And she is off for another adventure this summer. So if you stop and talk to Betty Sue for more than 10 minutes, you are likely to hear how God is at work around the world. And I could sit and listen for hours to her stories. We are blessed to have her share with us this morning. You may have noticed when you picked up coffee or muffins this morning, there were some interesting little artifacts around the flowers over there, and those are some treasures that Betty Sue has brought back from her adventures around the world. So if you want to go check those out later, you can. So welcome, Betty Sue.
Thank you. Good morning, ladies. I was going to say it's a privilege to be here, but it's also scary. But it is a privilege, and I thank you for coming, and we will talk about how do we walk alongside one another well. Life is hard sometimes. Sometimes it's easy. We're not alone. We can experience God's abundant grace in hard times, in times of crisis. And that's the first thing I'm going to talk about. The second session, we'll talk about just daily walking. But right now, I want to talk about walking in the hard times, in the time of crisis. Bear one another's burdens, the Lord says, or Paul says in Galatians 6:4. And the word for burden there is not a light little backpack. It's a heavy thing. So a little later, he says, each of us should bear our own load. That's like our own backpack. But when he says, bear one another's burdens, those are the times when it's too heavy. And you need somebody alongside to help bear your burden. So I want to talk a little bit about walking together with the Lord and with one another in times of crisis. And I want to talk about a special person. His name is Tom. And I can't see up there. I don't know if we got a thing that I can see there. So Tom was the oldest of six children, and when he was 20 months old, his twin sisters were born. That was a real challenge for his mom, to have a 20-month-old, very, very adventurous young man and twin little girls. And when her back was turned and she was taking care of the girls, he would unlock the front door. He figured out how to do that, and he would explore the neighborhood. She would turn around and he's not there, and she'd go out the front door, and there was a man across the street, and he would simply point one way or the other, and she would go find this little boy. And that was the theme of his life, was adventuresome. You name it, he probably tried it. Very, very adventuresome. And he was also an athlete. So he learned to bicycle very young, and when he was about 10, he started bicycling down to his grandmother and grandmother's house about 40 miles away in Colorado. Now, if you know Colorado, the roads are like this, a lot of ups and downs, and he would bicycle all the way to his grandparents' house 40 miles away. When he was 13, he began to deliver, now this younger ones will not even know what this means, he began to deliver telegrams. Now, a telegram was an emergency message that somebody would send you, and if you had a phone, they would call you up and tell you the message. But if you didn't have a phone, people would ride their bikes and their cars all over the city delivering these slips of paper that were hard to read. And he, at 13, was delivering telegrams all over the city of Colorado Springs. He, at 13, he was making enough money that he saved money to go to Bible camp. And he said to his dad, I want to go to Bible camp in Estes Park. And his dad said, son, that's a great idea, but I have no money to send you. He said, no, Dad, I've saved my own money. Well, I can't take time off work to take you. And he said, Dad, I can bicycle. Now, it's 70 miles to Denver and another 65 miles up into the mountains from Denver. And this 13-year-old is bicycling. He approaches Denver, and the police stopped him. Young man, you are running away from home. No, sir, I'm going to Bible camp. Likely story. Here is a backpack and a bicycle. Said, no, sir, I am going to Bible camp. Does your dad know where you're going? Yes. He gave me permission. Give me your dad's phone number. So he called his dad up at work, and the policeman said, do you know where your son is? He looked at his watch. He should be approaching Denver right about now on his bicycle. And the police let him go. And at that camp, he gave his life to the Lord. He'd been under conviction for a period of time. His parents took him to church, took the whole family to church every Sunday. But he was fighting that. And he said he remembers going into the house. Busy house with six kids and two parents and always somebody there. And one day he walked into the house. Mom! No answer. Mary! Martha! No answer. Goes through the list. Nobody answered. And he walked all through the house and couldn't find anybody. And he thought, the Lord came and took them all, and I'm left behind. So it was shortly after that, at camp, that he gave his life to the Lord. And that was an important thing for him for a little while. And then he got involved in athletics. Now, this strong young man that could bicycle that far could also swim long distance and run long distance and ski long distance. He said to me once, I was never very fast, but as fast as I was, I could go forever. And that apparently was true. And so he got involved in all sorts of different kinds of athletics. And he lived at the base of Pikes Peak Mountain in Colorado Springs. Now, Pikes Peak is a tall mountain there. It's, let's see, I was going to compare it. Mount Hood is 11,000, Mount Rainier is 14,004, and Pikes Peak is 14,001. So it's a tall mountain. They lived at the base, and before breakfast, for the sheer fun of it, I don't understand it, he would run partway up the mountain. That's not my idea of fun. But he loved that mountain, and he loved to run it. And in the fall of summer of 1956, there was a Finnish man, a man from Finland, who was very anti-smoking. And he challenged across the U.S. any smoker and non-smoker who wanted to come and run up and down Pikes Peak. And he said, let's see if the smokers can finish. Well, there were 13 runners. Tom was 16. He was one of the non-smokers. None of the smokers made the round trip. And so this man said it proved his point. And Tom came in second as a 16-year-old. The man who came in first was Mr. America. He had his own physical culture studio there in Colorado Springs, and he was known across the U.S. His name was Monty Wilford, and he was Mr. America, and he came in first. And they became friends, and a little later that year, someone decided to do a full official marathon, and they started at the bottom, went back up, and came back down. And they ran it together, and again, Tom came in second. You can see a couple trophies up here, different years that he came in second and won a trophy. The third year, third time they ran it, he came in second, and it was a photo finish. They had to actually look at the photograph to see who won. And Monty Wilford said to him, you are going to be an outstanding runner, a 16, 17-year-old running like that. When you're 20, you'll hit your stride. You will be outstanding. Well, the Lord had a different plan for him other than that. But he did have powerful legs and a huge lung capacity growing up in that high altitude. So he went to that summer in 1958 when he was 18. He went to a YMCA camp. You can see the beautiful lake in that photograph of the camp where he was. There's a camp in Michigan near Muskegon, Michigan, called Twin Lakes. And he was swimming instructor and I don't know other activities that summer. Near the end of the summer, they purchased a used playground slide, and they put it up in the edge of the water. And you've seen kids go down the slide into water. But you'll notice now that almost all the slides have a curve at the end to slow people down because they found that's extremely dangerous. I walked under that slide years later, and it was way, way above my head. Now, I'm short, but I'm sure it was at least 7 feet at the top. And he was first down the slide because he's a swimming instructor. He had first dibs. So he got on the slide, and down he goes, and he was going really fast. So instead of sitting this adventuresome guy, he has to lie down face first, head first, on his stomach. Down he goes, and it's a really fast slide. And he got about two-thirds of the way down, and he decided he was going too fast and went to reach for the edge of the slide to slow himself down and missed. And he went off the end of the slide with his hands out like this. When you dive, where do you put your hands? You protect your head. You protect your neck. He didn't. He was landing like this. Went off the end of the slide. It was quite a ways down to the water. He didn't hit the bottom. He just hit the water. And he hit it so hard, going so fast, that it jammed his head against his chest and broke his neck. One vertebra slid over the other one and severed his spinal cord. What could he do? Absolutely nothing. Suddenly, he could do nothing but hold his breath. Praise God, he was able to hold his breath. So he's lying there in the water, doing the dead man's float, holding his breath. And because he was sort of a trickster, everybody thought he was playing games. Oh, Tom, get out of the way. Other people want their turn. And he's lying there at the base of the slide. And so they decided he was playing a game. They would play a game with him. And they grabbed him by the shoulder and yanked him away, expecting to have a water fight. And, of course, there was no water fight. There was no resistance. So they pulled him up onto the beach, not thinking there might be some damage there. They just thought he was drowning. They pulled him up onto the beach, flipped him over onto his back, preparing to give mouth to mouth. And he said, no, I'm breathing, but I think I have a pinched nerve. Take me to the city and talk to the doc and get this nerve unpinched, because I got to come back and teach swimming this afternoon. So they put him in the back of a station wagon, back seat of a station wagon, nurse sitting on one side, and they sort of folded him up in the back seat with his head on the nurse's lap, and she's holding his head over this rough road going into town, and got into the city. And sorry about my allergy. You're going to see this. By the way, this is my mother's. Isn't that pretty? I'm turning 80 this year, and I suddenly thought, if I'm ever going to use this stuff, I better start doing it now. So this is hers, and you'll see it a lot because my allergies have kicked in. So anyway, he got to the doctor, and he said to the doc, could you please get this unkinked really fast because I have to go back out and teach swimming. He said, the doc didn't pay any attention to me. He began to drill holes in my skull to straighten his back, put him on a bed, and then he called a specialist. And the specialist said, oh, don't bother me. When he described the situation, he's not going to live 48 hours. Don't bother me. I won't. No use bothering me. So the doctor called Tom's parents in Colorado. They had never traveled out of Colorado. They had a friend who had a small plane, got in the plane, flew up to Michigan and walked in his hospital room, and they hadn't told Tom that this was serious. And so they walked into his hospital room, and he said, what are you doing here? I've just got a pinched nerve. And his dad said, son, the doctor says you probably won't make it 48 hours. You have far worse than a pinched nerve. If this is your time to go, will our family circle be unbroken in heaven? Because Tom was not living for the Lord at all. He was living for athletics and living for the fast life. And Tom said, yes, I know I have been disobedient, but I am God's child, and you will see me in heaven. Well, shortly after that, his parents left. His dad had to go back to work, and his mom had 5 more kids to tend to, and so they left. And he was there in a hospital room in a city where he knew absolutely no one, not one person. The people in the camp left a few days later. The camp closed, and he was alone in this city. Well, he lived 48 hours. They called the specialist, and the specialist said, young man, after doing all the tests and checking everything out, young man, I hear you used to be an athlete. Good bedside manner, right? I hear you used to be an athlete. You are no longer. As a matter of fact, we know you'll never walk. We don't know if you'll ever sit up. We don't know if you'll ever use your hands. So you better figure out a way to use your head. And walked out. And said, and Tom heard him say to the nurse, send in a psychiatrist. I just messed him up. Well, praise God, he didn't mess him up. This began Tom's honeymoon with the Lord. Fresh walk with the Lord. They put Tom on what's called a striker frame, which is a bed like this. You lay face up for a while. Then they put another mattress on top, flip the whole thing over, take this one off, and you're lying on your back for a while. And then flip the whole thing over, and you're lying on your stomach for a while. And day and night, every little while, they would rotate him. He called it his rotisserie. And there he was, knowing nobody. Well, what happened? When he was on his back, they put a glass shelf over his bed, and they put his Bible, he asked them, and he had his Bible with him, and they put his Bible face down on the shelf so that he could read his Bible through the glass shelf. And he said, sometimes I read the same chapter for hours before the nurse came in, and that was good. When he was lying on his stomach, there was a little window in the mattress, and they would put his Bible on the floor, and he could read the Bible that way. And that was just a precious time with the Lord. And then one of the nurses, who was a Christian, and she was one of the ones that would put his Bible out, she talked to her brother. And her brother was one of the athletes, I forget, baseball or some athletics. And she told him about this young man about his age who was in the hospital. And so this brother named Phil came to visit Tom in the hospital. And Phil and Tom just became very precious friends. And Phil is still a friend after all these years. Phil then began to tell his friends. And he told his Bible study group, and they came and met Tom. And then he told his team, and they came and met Tom. And then they told the Youth for Christ group, and they came and met Tom. And by God's grace, the hospital lifted all visiting regulations, and he could have as many kids as he wanted in his room day and night. And sometimes they were there late, late at night. And they would have their pizza parties in his room, and he'd like to be on his stomach so he could see them. They would sit on the floor under his bed and eat pizza, and he would eat pizza. And he said, I was sort of Dear Abby. When they broke up with their girlfriends, they'd come out, oh, what do I do now? They would have troubles, and they would come and talk to him. And they had parties, and they had Bible studies, and they had prayer times together. And that group of young men was such a blessing to Tom as they walked alongside him through those really difficult times. He was in that hospital 9 months. Now they try to get people into rehab right away. They try to get people sitting up. He didn't even sit up for 9 months. So he didn't know if he would even be capable of sitting up. And after 9 months, they sat him up and got him used to sitting up, and then they flew him to Colorado for rehab. Before he left the hospital, he asked the hospital if he could have a party for his friends. And they said, how many? He said, lots. So they opened up the cafeteria, and he had more than 100 young men, a few young women, come to his party. They were all people he had met in his hospital room, people that God had brought to walk alongside him. If he had not had them, I think it would have been much, much harder for him to survive those 9 months and to thrive in those 9 months. And eventually he was able to sit up, and eventually he was able to... there's a picture of him in his wheelchair. He used his hands a little bit. If you've seen Johnny Erickson Tada, he had the same level of injury that she had. But by God's grace, he had a little return in his hands. So he could hold a cup. He could feed himself. He could do things that she couldn't do. His left hand was... basically, he could just push things around. It was pretty useless. But his right hand had a little bit of a pinch. He wasn't strong, but he could do things. And he was blessed by having that. Judy, I'm going to show the other one. So after a while, he decided that he wanted to be... He got his bachelor's degree. He got his master's degree in counseling psychology. And then he thought he wanted to be a missionary. So he wrote to a number of mission boards and asked them to send him. And they all said, oh, Tom... you're so handicapped. Now, this is the days before you have to do everything for handicapped. They all said no, 100%. No, no. You have good training. You can make money. You send missionaries. You stay in the States. Well, that was not his call. His call was to go somewhere else. So he decided that he would go to Mexico and just see if he could survive. He went to Mexico, and he heard about a place where young men in wheelchairs could stay, and they had special people to care for them. And he stayed there for a few weeks, and he got absolutely bored because, he said, he liked to play chess. He liked to have a good discussion, talk about issues, talk about history. And he said those guys, all they want to do is get drunk and talk about girls and gamble. And that was not something of interest to him. So he called a missionary in the city and he said, where can I meet young Christian people? And he said, oh, there's a language school is opening up. Go to the language school. The Sunday night they have their introductory meeting and you can meet some Christian young people. So Tom went to the introduction meeting and decided, yeah, why not learn Spanish? The place where he was staying was quite far from the school, so he found out about this little motel a few blocks from school that was a kitchenette and had a bedroom, and he moved in there. Now, here's the adventuresome part. He moved in there by himself. There was no way he could get in and out of bed by himself. So he moved in there, and that night he grabbed a pillow off the bed and put it on the table, put his head on the pillow, and slept. In the morning, he opened his Bible, and he said, you say here that you clothe the grass of the field. I need to be clothed. Just then, this young man knocks at the door. Young man knew about 4 words of English, and Tom knew about 5 words of Spanish, and somehow they managed to communicate enough that this young man got breakfast for Tom and helped him get dressed and helped him get to school, where then there was somebody at school that could translate for them, and Tom hired this young man. And this young man became Tom's very special friend and helper. And after a while, Tom led this young man to the Lord, and he taught him, Jesus loves me. Well, that didn't express Lolo's heart. And Lolo, that song just didn't do it for him. So he came back to Tom a few days later, and he said, Tomas, I've got a song. Can I sing it for you? Yeah, so he had written this song. I'm going to sing it for you. The song says, I get up in the morning and God blesses me with his breath and he takes care of me and I'm not afraid of the enemy because the enemy can't get in now because I belong to Jesus. Yo me levanto por la mañana y con su viento me alaba Dios. Yo no le temo al enemigo porque me cuida mi Padre Dios. El enemigo anda muy cerca, anda rodeando mi corazón, pero ya es tarde, no gana nada, porque Cristo está en mi corazón. Retírate, Satanás, no vengas a perturbar, que al cabo en mi corazón tú ya no podrás entrar, tú ya no podrás entrar. That was what he needed to know, was the enemy is around him, can't get in. Jesus is there. And he and Tom became very good friends. Well, Tom and I became friends. I was at that same language school. And I had just graduated from Bible college a couple years previously, planning on going to Venezuela as a missionary, and the door was closed, and I couldn't go. And I didn't know what to do, and I was frustrated and really puzzled about what God had for me. I went to this language school in Mexico to refresh my Spanish, spend time with the Lord, and just figure out what I was supposed to do next. I took the 3-month refresher course and still didn't know what I was supposed to do. So the school said, would you? By then they had hired Tom as the assistant director, and he was in charge of counseling and other things. And they said, would you be willing to work at the school as a volunteer and do some teacher training and do some curriculum development? Because those are not areas that Tom is strong in. And so I began to work for Tom as his assistant and doing those things. And I got to know Tom. And I was impressed that here was a man who knew how to walk with the Lord. I remember that he read 1 Peter, one of the first times when he gave his testimony in chapel, and he read 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 3 through 9, where it talks about how we want to glorify God. And he said, verse 6 and 7, "In all this you greatly rejoice, though now, for a little while, you may have to suffer grief in all kinds of trials. These trials have come so that the proven genuineness of your faith, of greater worth than gold, which perishes, even though refined by fire, may result in praise, glory, and honor when Jesus Christ is revealed." That our faith is greater than gold, and it's refined by fire. And Tom said, a miner doesn't put just any old dirt in the fire. That's useless. He takes dirt that is valuable, that he knows has ore. And he said, if you are going through fire, it means you're not just any old dirt. God has found gold in you, gold worth refining. And if you are going through the fire, it's because he is refining you until you are the gold that brings glory to him and praise to him, because you're not just any old dirt. And so we worked together for a year. And then after a year, we decided to make it permanent. And so we not only worked together, but we got married. And this is our wedding. We were working at the language school in Mexico, and we were married half in Spanish and half in English, because some of our friends didn't know Spanish yet, and a lot of our friends didn't know English. And so we did the ring ceremony in English, and we said our vows in Spanish, and we had music in both languages. And my friends said to me, "Betty Sue, you're going to be so bored. Just taking care of one man all your life, never going anywhere, never doing anything." And I thought, you don't know the adventurer that I married. Well, I didn't know either, and I had no idea the adventure that awaited us. We were in over 70 countries. And but I knew that this was something that God had for us, and I knew it wasn't going to be a boring life. I'm so thankful for the people around Tom that helped him, that walked with him through this hard time. Those guys in his hospital room, Lolo, other friends at the school that have over the years walked with the two of us and through the hard times, that God has been precious to us, that he has helped us and encouraged us. I have a little video that I would like to show, a little taste of Tom talking about his accident and a few pictures of the three of us.
At the time of my injury, God caused me to reflect on the purpose of life. I am convinced that God gives us our life for a reason. And he had given me my life again a second time before I really stopped to realize that. But I'm convinced that God doesn't give us our life the first time without a reason. After my injury, my attitude was not one of questioning God. God, why did you do this to me? Or why has this happened to me? Rather, the attitude God gave me was one of a realization that God is the life giver. He had given me my life again. And so my question was, God, why have you spared my life? Why have you given me my life again? And during the last quarter of a century, it's been a privilege for us to learn, to experience the plan that God has had for our life.
The Brewsters are a unique husband-wife team. Their travels have carried them to over 80 countries in their work of helping missionaries learn languages and minister effectively. Together with their son Jedediah, they travel to conduct workshops and courses.
I thought you would enjoy a little taste of the special man that I married. We were married almost 19 years. And as he mentioned, we traveled all over the world. People call us missionaries. We're actually missionary trainers because we haven't spent very much time in any one place. You can imagine, in 19 years, that many countries, you don't spend a lot of time in any one place. But we were training missionaries and local people about cross-cultural work, about language learning, about living for the Lord. And that training took us to all those different places, and we were blessed by so many people that walked with us through that time. And then Tom began to have long-term consequences from being in the wheelchair, and things became difficult, and we realized that he probably would not live too much longer. When I married Tom, the doctor said to me at that time, you know, most men in wheelchairs, they live a very short time. You know that you will be a young widow. Well, he actually outlived all of their predictions, and our son was 6 years old when Tom died in 1985. That was a huge, huge change in my life, going from a 24-hour-a-day marriage to nothing. Very often, when you're a widow, part of your life is the same as it had been previously, but for me, nothing was the same. Mealtimes weren't the same because I was used to helping him. Nighttimes weren't the same because I was used to getting up 2 and 3 times a night to turn him, to give him a glass of water, and most of all, because he was this visionary, he was most of all writing down his great thoughts for the next thing we were going to do. I always had a little pad of paper by the table, by the bed, and he would poke me in the middle of the night. Now, I'm a heavy sleeper. He was a very light sleeper. He poked me. Honey, I got a new thought. Okay. Get out my pad of paper and my pen. You know what we should write about next? And then I fall asleep. And the lines go like this. And then he'd poke me. I'm not finished yet. And in the morning, I look at my pad of paper, and sometimes we both laugh, and sometimes there's really some good stuff there, and we... But nothing was the same. We taught together. We traveled together. We were together 24 hours a day. It was very rarely where we separated at all. Jed was used to a 24-hour-a-day dad. He was homeschooled. He was with us constantly. So for the two of us to suddenly not have Tom, who was such a colossus in our lives. He was the outgoing adventurer, visionary, and we're kind of left dazed a bit. And I am so thankful for people who came alongside me and walked with me through that crisis. That, who was I? I said to a very good friend as we were driving one day, I'm still trying to figure out who I am now. 6-year-old in the back seat says, no problem, Mommy. I know who you are. Oh, you're Betty Sue Brewster. You're my mom, and you're a teacher. End of discussion. He was very much involved in our life. One time somebody asked Tom, Jed was probably 4, asked Tom, so what do you do? This 4-year-old pipes up, we go around the world and we teach people how to learn languages. He was so much part. He went to every class with us. He sat with his toys and his books in the back. And pretty soon, he could quote a lot of the stuff that we taught. So we were very used to being together and suddenly not having him. Suddenly having to find out, really, who I am without Tom. And having friends walk alongside me and having friends pray with me, having friends bring food, having friends do the practical stuff, do my laundry, those days when I was still trying to figure everything out. I am very thankful when God surrounds us with people who love us, people who support us, people who walk with us through the crisis times. And I am very thankful for so many of those people that have been in my life, that I have been blessed by them. And I believe that many of you have had similar experiences. I know that some of you in this room are also widows, and I know some of you have gone through or are going through some very difficult times. And I pray that we can be women who are in the habit of supporting one another, of lifting one another, of bearing one another's burdens, not just the backpack burdens, but those heavy burdens that we don't know how to bear ourselves. And God gives us the privilege of coming alongside, so that when I have my burden, you help me. And then when you have your burden, the Lord gives me the privilege to help you. And we can support one another in those difficult times. We can walk with one another in those hard times. I thank God for all the scripture that he gave us during those times, he gave me during those times, of leaning on the Lord and trusting the Lord and walking with the Lord through those hard times. At our wedding, some of you have the little bookmark that says, "Oh, magnify the Lord with me, and let us exalt his name together." And that was the theme for our wedding, was magnify the Lord and exalt the Lord together. And that was the theme of our life, is how can we together magnify the Lord? How can we together exalt the Lord? And that was our joy. And then 1 Thessalonians 5:11 says, "Therefore encourage one another and build one another up, just as you also are doing," that we can walk alongside and encourage one another. That God's grace is sufficient. You know that? Sometimes we need to remind one another of that, that God's grace is enough. God's grace is sufficient to walk with us through those hard times, through those crisis times. In the Bible, we read various people who went through crisis. Our Bible study group has been studying the book of Ruth, and I think of Naomi. Naomi walked through a crisis, do you remember? She and her husband and two boys left Israel and went all the way over to Moab. And in Moab, her husband died. Her sons married Moabite women. Her sons died. And here's Naomi. No close relatives, no family, no people around her. And she wants to go back home. But going home is a long journey. It's more than a week to walk home from Moab. She's lost her husband. She's lost her boys. She's almost lost her faith. She's just holding on to her faith, sort of by her fingernails. Just sure that the Lord has spanked her really hard and maybe she doesn't deserve anything else. And she says, "The Lord has been so hard to me." And then what happens? She gets ready to go, and her two daughters-in-law walk with her to the edge of town, as is appropriate. In most other countries, you don't just say goodbye at the door. So you walk a ways with them. And so they walked a ways down the road with her. And when it was evident that it was quite a ways, she said to them, "Okay, thanks for walking with me. Now, go back home. I've got to walk this road by myself. You go back home." And Orpah, the very practical one, agrees. And she walks home. Kisses her, hugs her. She obviously loved her. She cries with her. And then she goes home. And the other daughter-in-law, Ruth, you remember that Ruth said, "I'm going to go with you." Ruth was God's special gift to Naomi at this time, to walk with her through this crisis time. Some of us have had our Ruths who walk with us through the crisis time. Naomi tries to convince her to go back. "Look, Orpah's gone back. What is there for you? If you go to Israel with me, what is there for you?" She didn't say it, but they're both thinking, yeah, you're going to be a foreigner in a foreign land. You won't know anybody. What's the point of going with me? And Naomi says, "No, the Lord has been harder on me than on you, so just go back." And Ruth replies, "No, don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, for your God is my God." Ruth had seen something in Naomi, even through those hard times, even when Naomi was holding on to her faith by her thumbnails, she had seen something in Naomi of God. Sometimes in our crisis times, we're not sure how much we show of God, but something that she showed of God, so much that Ruth said, "I'm going to go with you, because I don't just love you, but I love your God too. And I want to be with you, and I want to be with your God." Orpah had seen the love of Naomi, but she hadn't seen the love of God. But in this hard time, Ruth had seen not only the love of Naomi, but she had seen the love of God. And she became the special gift to Naomi to walk with her that over a week's walk through the desert, through that hot place, through difficulty, choosing to bear with her the difficulty. And Ruth and Naomi got back home. The women say, "Oh, look at Naomi." And she said, "No, I'm not Naomi. I'm Mara. Naomi means pleasant. And I don't feel pleasant at all. I feel bitter. The Lord has dealt so hard with me." But there was something about her that was not just bitter, that Ruth saw. And Ruth walked with her. And soon the Lord was healing Naomi of that bitterness and replenishing her faith in the Lord. And so by the next chapter, Naomi is saying, "Praise the Lord for this, that, and the other." And Naomi is regaining her faith. And it was partly the special gift of Ruth walking with her through that crisis time that let her regain her faith. I have had friends who've gone through crisis times who really are hardly even holding on to their faith. And what do? We uphold them in prayer. We just keep praying for them. "Lord, let them keep holding on. Even by their fingernails, let them hold on. And let them find that they're not just Mara. They're Naomi. They are still pleasant. You still love them. We will walk beside them. We will uphold them in their faith. We will encourage them." And some of you have been that for one another. When you know when another is really struggling with your faith and struggling, "Does God love me, or has he slapped me so hard that I'm not even his anymore?" We walk together. Those days when I'm tired and I want to fall down, you pick me up. And those days when you're tired and you want to fall down, we pick you up. That's why we're here together, because we want to walk alongside each other. We want to be those people who pick each other up. You know what that means? That means something hard for me, and that is to be vulnerable and say, "I'm struggling. I need somebody to pray with me. I have a problem. Pick me up. I'm not strong enough today to walk by myself. Hold me as I walk." And we can keep walking beside one another, keep encouraging one another. "Therefore, encourage one another and build one another up, just as you are also doing." 1 Thessalonians 5:11. It's a little early, but I'm going to stop here.